Just want to thank you as a church for letting me be with you for 4 weeks together. So I can't believe it's already come to the end of those 4 weeks at this time. And so I'm grateful for the chance to have opened God's word with you and been a part of your community here for a month. It's been delightful. And so thank you for welcoming me. And I'm also just going to say it's sad for me as we come to the end of that. I'm also going to give a caveat. One of the delightful things about your community is just the time of chit-chatting after the service. Today I can participate for a couple minutes, but I can't stay very long. I did schedule this. There's a marriage counseling that I'm going to do with someone down in the North Hills that I need to get back for. And so my wife reminded me this morning that, hey, do you remember this? And I said, I do not remember that, but I will be back for that. So I will make it as timely as I can, but I want to let you know it's me, not you. If you think I'm heading out the door really quickly, if that seems really abrupt to you, that's me, not you guys. Well, it was October 1903, and a few first-time visitors sneaked into a church service in Cleveland, and they were waiting to see if the person with whom they hoped to see showed up. And in fact, this person did. And throughout the service, these visitors stared at this gentleman, trying to make sense of who is this unique man who showed up. And then during the greeting time, they got up and actually went over. They thought for sure this might cause a scene. It did not, fortunately, but they went over and they greeted this person. And later, one of these visitors would write that this man had a large face with a thin nose like a horn and no lips. And then she'd go on and say, I was sorry for him. For all the conscious power written in face and voice and figure, he was afraid, I told myself, afraid of his own kind. Great power written on his mummy-like head and lust and death. The visitor was Ida Tarbell, and she was there that day to see John D. Rockefeller, who had destroyed her father's business. And she was trying to make sense of this person who had become very wealthy and yet would show up every Sunday and gave 10% of his income for most of his life. He's an interesting figure, because on one hand, he's a cutthroat business person. He had corporate espionage. He would go in and buy other companies, have them not wear the standard oil label, go in and undercut local businesses, force them out of business, then buy them all up. And so he was very cutthroat. And yet, on the other side, we see him giving very generously throughout his life. He was a committed Christian, attended church. How do we make sense of this? And what does it look like to be a follower of Jesus and have resources and have money? Jesus has a lot to say about having money. And even the Gospel of Luke especially emphasizes Christ's concern about the poor and the issue that wealth can create for us. He has hard things to say about you can't serve God and money. You've got to pick. Even in the Sermon on the Mount, Sermon on the Mount says, blessed are the poor, and just leaves it there. Matthew has, blessed are the poor in spirit. And so there is more this emphasis on the poor being a recipient of God's goodness, and a bit more of a caveat of, is it okay to be wealthy and still be a follower of Jesus? That's a bit more of a question mark. The chapter before our passage today actually raises this question even more. We have the encounter with the rich young ruler, whom asks, what do I have to do to be saved? And he keeps all the commandments, and Jesus says, look, just sell everything you have, and you'll be okay. And he walks away sad because he had a lot of stuff. And then everyone's looking in saying, well, how can a rich man be saved? And Jesus says, with man it's impossible, but with God all things are possible. And if that were the final word on wealth and following Jesus, it might seem like there's no path forward, because you'd have to thread the camel has to go through the eye of the needle, and that's a pretty difficult thing. And yet, in our passage today, we're going to meet a rich man who, in fact, threads that very needle. We're going to see a rich man who, when he encounters Jesus, is overwhelmed and suddenly realizes that the kingdom is about so much more than his stuff. He's going to give it away, up to half of his income. And then he's going to make restitution. Anyone that he's defrauded, he says, look, I'm going to pay you back fourfold. So we're going to see in our passage, this rich man, he's going to be an unlikely kind of person to seek out Jesus. He's going to seek Jesus out. And then Jesus is going to invite himself into his life. And through that encounter, he's going to decide, I'm now going to make restitution of the wrongs I've done and follow this Jesus. But what's interesting in all this, while we see this rich man seeking Jesus, ultimately we're going to learn that the seeker was sought from the very beginning. It's only because there was the Son of Man who came to seek and to save the lost that Zacchaeus is looking for and trying to figure out who is this Jesus and how does it matter for him. So let's turn to Luke chapter 19. We're going to be looking at the story of Zacchaeus, a probably very well-known story, and yet I think a very powerful story that exemplifies what it looks like to live in this kingdom. How do we have this world's goods and yet use them in the way that the king would ask us to use them? So we're going to see first that this unlikely person, this rich man, is going to encounter Jesus of Nazareth. This is in chapter 19, verse 1. Let me begin here. It says, he entered Jericho and was passing through. And there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. And he was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was small of stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. So a couple of things to take note of here. It talks about Jesus here entering Jericho. I've been talking about the fact that this whole section of Luke's called the on-the-way narrative. He's making his way to Jerusalem. And in fact, in this chapter, chapter 19, verse 28, he's going to get to Jerusalem. That's the triumphal entry. That's Palm Sunday. So we're almost there. This Zacchaeus story forms one of the last climaxes of this on-the-way narrative. So you think about how are people reacting to Jesus? Well, guess what? As he goes into Jericho, here's this rich man who's going to come and follow Jesus. So even as we're about to enter Jerusalem, we're still seeing people turn around and say, I want to repent of my life and come and follow this Jesus. Now, we learn about this guy named Zacchaeus. People are a little unsure about what it means to be named Zacchaeus. Some people say it just means to be clean or pure. Others say it has more to do with a name like Zechariah, righteousness. God is my righteousness. I don't really have the chops to really debate that, so I don't know. It's either clean or righteous. I leave it up to you to decide which one that might be. More important, though, than his name is that he's a chief tax collector and very rich. Let me unpack this for you. So the chief tax collector meant he was the head honcho of the tax collectors. Tax collectors were not very well liked. Now, they functioned differently than they function today. So a tax collector back then is not one who just takes income tax. What they would have done is they would have bid out the job to the Romans. And as you would go into a town like Jericho, if you were a merchant, you would have to pay for the goods that you were bringing in. It'd be like a duty tax. So as you brought your donkeys with pots and silverware and things like that on it, you'd have to pay on the value of those goods. Now, there was a set amount you had to pay to the Romans, but you could fudge that. And so if you see a really wealthy trader coming along, he's got a lot of nice stuff, a lot of silver stuff. It's like, maybe I can add a little bit more. And it was known practice among these tax collectors to inflate the taxes. And they really were at the beck and call of the tax collector. So whatever you levied against them, they had to pay it. And so you got paid out of that too. We also paid the Romans. So they had a double whammy. They were known to be corrupt and line their own pockets with people's hard-earned money, but then they're also very pro-Roman because they were working for the Roman government. So they were sellouts from the Jewish perspective. So you had both, they were politically aligned with the Romans and then also taking from the locals who are working very hard for their money and then becoming rich from it. And it says right here, he was very rich. So he falls in this category of the rich people. How does that rich person come and relate to Jesus? Well, we're going to find out here in the next couple of verses. So it's very fascinating. Jesus is coming to town. The crowds are mobbing him. So he's got an entourage there that's prohibiting Zacchaeus from seeing Jesus. Now it says he's seeking to see him. And I'm always curious, well, why does he have this interest? Why is this curiosity in Zacchaeus? Has he heard from fellow tax collectors in other towns? Hey, the rabbis don't like us, but this Jesus guy, he's got a different vibe towards us. Maybe the reputation's already come around to Zacchaeus that Jesus is actually open to talking to you. Jesus makes space for you. Just because you're a tax collector and everyone else is against you, he'd be willing to come to your house. I don't know why he's seeking, but he's interested in something. He's got something that primes him to want to see this Jesus person, so much so he climbs a sycamore tree. And he's waiting there along the road. You can imagine this spectacle. Here comes the mob around Jesus, the victory parade, whatever, into Jericho. And there's a guy in a tree. That strikes me as kind of odd. I don't know if that's common back then, but it strikes me as odd. Like, here's a grown man standing in a tree trying to peer into the crowd and be like, hey, Jesus, oh. And you can imagine everyone's trying to get his attention. They want to talk to him. And what's very fascinating, here is this unlikely person. Everybody else would just ignore him or hate him. And Jesus is not going to ignore him. It's very easy in our world to also have some more people that we think, well, that person, they've sold out to the dark side. There's no way that person is coming back. There's no hope for that person. Jesus is not going to think that about the tax collector. I imagine many of the contemporaries would have looked at the tax collector and said, look, you've already made your bed, just lie in it. You know, we're done with you. We're about restoring Israel over here. Forget those tax collectors. Jesus will not. In our own day and age, it's easy to write off certain categories of people as they're too far gone. I know right now we have a lot of anti-gang rhetoric or anti-immigrant rhetoric, whatever we have different categories of people that we say, that person is just not within the pale of restoration and redemption. And yet God specializes in those people that we seem to write off as society, as people, and say, those are the ones God has come to also save as well. One of the things I've found very helpful for my own faith is reading the testimonies at the back of Christianity Today. So if you ever picked up a Christianity Today article or magazine, at the very last page is usually a testimony of somebody. And one of the more recent ones was of a guy who grew up and got bullied into the gangs of his neighborhood. He didn't really want to join, but they forced him in. He had to measure up to being a man, and so he ended up joining this gang. And he remembers around 21 when a rival gang shot one of his friends. And then he decided to get involved in a reprisal killing. And so they went and did a hit. And he said, fortunately for him, his gun actually jammed, so he didn't have to actually take anybody's life. However, he was arrested, and that very night, he was going into jail, and someone offered him a Bible as he's being hauled in the prison that very night for the first time. And he refused it initially. I don't want that. Well, but while he's over there stewing, figuring out, like, hey, I'm 21. I'm now probably in prison for the rest of my life. What am I doing? How did I get here? They looked back at the person who'd offered him the Bible and said, you know what, I want that. Started reading. And just reading, it was like, I need this. And so here's the people that we think like hardened gang members. Like there's no way. They're entrenched in their hard life. Suddenly this moment of softness in prison, like I need something. So we shouldn't write people off. And so we have categories that we think, oh, that person, they're unlikely to listen to the gospel or hear the good news about Jesus. Guess what? God's bringing people from all walks of life, from all backgrounds. God specializes in bringing tax collectors and others that we would say, you know what, we're done with you. God specializes in calling them to himself. And in fact, Jesus is now going to invite himself into the life of this man. Take a look at verse 5. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. This is a very, very fascinating thing. So Jesus walks by, and you can imagine everybody else probably in the crowd would have loved to have Jesus invite himself into their house too. But Jesus goes over to this tree with this guy up in it and says, I'm coming to your house. And he says, I must come. In the Greek, there's this word day. It means it is necessary. It has to happen this way. This is how it's destined to be. Now, I think what Jesus is, the necessity behind this is that he's on a mission to find the lost sheep of Israel. But Jesus says, look, this is what I'm here for. I'm here to talk to you. And so he invites himself, says, look, today I'm going to come and stay in your house. And so verse 6, so he hurried and came down and received him joyfully. But notice the other response, verse 7, and when they saw it, they all grumbled. He has gone in to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. So here's Jesus inviting himself into this man's house. And there's two responses. Zacchaeus is really joyful. Yes, this guy who I was curious about, interested in, he just invited himself over for lunch today. This is great. So he's having the time of his life. Meanwhile, the townsfolk who are welcoming Jesus, walking with him, they're sitting there grumbling. He's going to that sinner's house. This is not the guy they wanted him to go to his house for lunch. And you know what? These kinds of responses are still very common in the church today. That when sinners start showing up, we grumble, we complain. I remember when I was in youth group, who would go on to be a good friend of mine, he came to faith about age 16, and he was living pretty much a party lifestyle up until that point. Comes to church, has this dramatic conversion. We all like to tell that story. It was a great story. But then he started inviting his friends to the lock-ins, to the youth events. And next thing I know, the parents are like, hey, we can't have these kids showing up here. I mean, they swear. They talk about other things we'd rather not have our kids exposed to. Like, we created a youth group to preserve our kids from all this stuff. And they started grumbling because guess what? People different than them were showing up. Instead of seeing this as a great moment when, hey, look, the sinners are coming to hear about the good news of Jesus and to receive the love that we had to give them, they were upset. And Jesus, even Jesus, so think about this, even Jesus going and reaching out to Zacchaeus had critics, people making fun of him, like, what are you doing that for? That doesn't make any sense. Why did you go to his house? Don't you know your reputation is going to go down the tubes after this? But that was not Christ's motivation. He was on a mission. So it didn't matter what people thought about him. It didn't matter about the social opprobrium that got thrown upon him. Jesus was going to love the people that he was there to reach. And so I would say this today. What does it look like to live like this? So not worry about the fears of people, the opinions of others. If we know we are called to reach out to somebody, go and do that. Don't let their fears, their opinions, their worries hold you back from loving others as Christ would have us love others. Be bold. Listen to the call of God, not to the fears of other people. So we've seen this unlikely person, this tax collector, reach out and say, Jesus, I want to come see you. Jesus then invites himself to his house for lunch. And here's what transpires. This encounter, and we don't get the conversation. I would love to hear the conversation. We get the end result of this, and that is Zacchaeus now plans to restore back whatever he's taken from somebody else. Look with me at verses 8 and 9. And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. Now, this is really fascinating. I'd love to see how he got to this place, but he pledges half of his net worth to give to the poor right then and there. This goes back. Think about the rich young ruler. Now, Jesus asked him to give it all. So here we're seeing, okay, the rich young ruler is only given half. That seems to be legitimate. So it's not like everybody's got to give everything away. So this Zacchaeus seems fully legitimate. This is a giving liberally of what he has. He's not holding on anymore to his stuff. Thinking back to the conversation about do you serve God or money? Well, this is fully entering into the kingdom of God where his money no longer owns him. He owns it. And he can give it away. So he's like, I'm going to give half of it away to the poor. That's one piece. The second piece, though, is the justice here. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. So Matthew read earlier from an account in Exodus, where if you stole a sheep and you killed it or sold it and they found out, you owed a 4-to-1 ratio back. Now, there's another ratio, and there's a 2-to-1 ratio, that if you still had the sheep alive, you only had to pay twice as much back. What's interesting is Zacchaeus chooses the higher ratio, the 4-to-1. Now, there was a higher one, 5-to-1 for the oxen. They were more valuable. But Zacchaeus picks the 4-to-1 ratio. That's costly. Think about that. Trying to go back to your records and figure out how many people you've defrauded and asked more than you should have asked, and then to quadruple that amount back. That's going to be a lot of money you're going to give back. And so Zacchaeus pledges both of these things, both to give half his net worth away, and then if he's ever stolen anything from anybody, to extort them, defraud them, whatever that looks like, he's going to pay back 4 times the amount. There's two pieces. giving liberally and then also making sure you settle accounts to pay the restitution. And Zacchaeus does both of those. And I think there's an invitation for us, too, to think, especially in America, we might not feel that we are wealthy compared to the world. We are wealthy. We have resources. How do we live under this king and not let them become a rival god to us? How do we use them for the sake of the kingdom? Zacchaeus is no longer owned by it, doesn't have to keep hoarding and grabbing and only making sure it's his. He can give it away freely. And part of living in the kingdom is to live generously, to live freely with the resources that God has given us. But then also to make sure that what we are doing, we're doing it justly. I know it's very easy, so part of my income is self-employed, and business expenses are really important because they help you lower your tax burden. And I know there's easy ways to expand that, to include other expenses that might be more personal than business. Are we being honest with how we account for our income? I also know it's easy to use legal means to defraud others. You can legally not pay people, knowing that it's going to cost them more to take you to court to make you pay. And so there's plenty of people who are just like, we had a contract, I'll pay you some, and let you figure out if you want to take me to court or not over the rest of that. And there's a question, how do we as Christians go about our business lives? How do we go about using our money? Do we try to just grab it however we can get it, or do we make sure that we're doing it in a way that's blessing others, that's just, that's not underhanded? Think about someone like a John D. Rockefeller. How do we not just give generously, but also do our business in a way that is going to be honoring to other people? That's going to be a fair, just marketplace. I know Christians personally who are business people that on the one hand will give generously, and they're known for their generosity, but then on the backside, when you deal with them as a buyer and a supplier, they make sure their buyers are paying right away, but then they let their suppliers' bills go unpaid for months. It's easy to keep the one piece of this, of giving liberally, and then not fall through the part with the part of justly dealing with others. What I find very sad, very interesting about Zacchaeus here is he's doing both. He's giving generously and saying, look, if I've stolen at all, I'm going to make it right. That's what it looks like to come to the king. Say, look, however I get my money, I'm going to make sure it's the right way. That's what I'm going to do. And so you have this transformation. Now here's this guy who's a public tax collector, the chief. He has this conversion where he comes around and says, you know what? I'm going to live my life entirely differently. I'm going to give my money away, and I'm going to now repay the people that I've defrauded for years. That would be a lot. You can imagine how Jericho might think about that afterwards, what they would be talking about. Hey, when Jesus came to town, look what happened to Zacchaeus. He's a whole new businessman as a result. Maybe more merchants decide to come and sell in Jericho as a result of that. Like, what does that do for a community when the person everyone's looking at is like, hey, I want to come do business there because my taxes are not going to be jacked up? So we see the last part here, this restitution, that Zacchaeus wants to now make it right. Now look at the proclamation Christ gives. And this is where we see that all this desire to see Jesus was already in motion because Jesus is looking for the lost sheep of Israel. So verse 9, and Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. So it's a very, very fascinating proclamation. Jesus says, look, today salvation has come here. And that salvation is wholeness of a whole life that is now being rescued from a way of defrauding others, now to being in the fullness of the kingdom. That this salvation, the salvation that Jesus brings, is now going to fall upon Zacchaeus and his household. Then he makes this comment, since he is also a son of Abraham. There's a little bit of debate over what does that mean to be a son of Abraham. And one line of thinking, probably in the line that I adopt, is that this is talking about him being a legit Jewish person who's a descendant of Abraham, part of the people that Jesus was sent to reach. Jesus often talks about his mission being to the Jewish people. And so Zacchaeus too. He might have fallen into the bracket of tax collector, but he too was a part of the target audience that Jesus was meant to reach. And guess what? Jesus just reached that group. Another line of thinking says it's more of like a spiritual membership. Think about the Apostle Paul when he talks about being a son of Abraham, being an heir. And so some folks think that this is more like you're following in the faith of your father Abraham. That could well be in play here. I don't want to denigrate it. That's why I brought it up. But at the same time, I find the other one more persuasive personally. Now, that brings up the question of how do we interpret this very encounter? There's another interpretation. I'm going to throw it out there just so you're aware of it. It's not the one I take. One interpretation of this points out that there's no actual literal or account of him repenting. And so that one reading of this is that Zacchaeus has always been this kind of person, that he is just born this label of tax collector and sinner by the population. And if you notice down in verse 8, when he says, I give to the poor, or if I have defrauded anyone, I restore it, those are present tense verbs, which would suggest that he's been doing this. Now, Greek, when they talk about tenses, the present tense can mean an ongoing thing that you've always been doing. Sometimes it's used as a futuristic thing. That's something I'm going to start doing or I will do in the future. So the one reading of Zacchaeus here says actually what's happening is Zacchaeus has been falsely accused by his fellow Jerichoites of being a thief. And he's actually not. And so Jesus goes there and Zacchaeus says, hey, look, this is what I'm doing. And Jesus is protecting him and saying, look, today this guy is actually a genuine business, you know, operator who's doing it legitimately. Stop giving him the label of a sinner and tax collector. You need to stop that. That's one reading. I'm not persuaded by that, and here's why. For me, it's hard to make sense of the proclamation, today salvation has come to this house, if he's already been doing it. It just seems like salvation simply means Jesus is going to correct the interpretation or the prejudice of the crowds. I think that today salvation has come speaks something more like, today something new has happened. There's been a conversion moment. And so I do take the reading that up until this point, there might be this curiosity, this spiritual openness on Zacchaeus' part. But that meeting with Jesus moves the needle across the line of saying, I'm in. I'm not just on the outside curious looking in, but I now want to follow this Jesus, be a part of his kingdom. And so I take that reading, which then has more of a conversion aspect here of where Zacchaeus is now, hey, I'm going to jump in and look, I'm looking back on my life. I see that I've defrauded my fellow citizens. I have exploited them and extorted my power over them for my personal gain. And I'm going to make it right. And so that is the reading that I believe is best represented here. There are folks, there are very good commentators out there that disagree with me on that, but that's the view I take. And so it's interesting, though, we see initially that Zacchaeus was seeking out this Jesus, trying to encounter him. But at the very end, we get this idea that, you know what? That seeker was already sought by somebody else. Because Jesus was on a mission to seek out the lost sheep of Israel. Look at verse 10. It says, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Jesus knew what he was about. He had come to seek and to save the lost, and tax collectors fell into that bracket. So did every other Jewish person as well. And Jesus says, look, I came, I found one, and look what's happened. This is beautiful. Can we receive that together? So Jesus knew what he was about, seeking and saving the lost. Now there's a prophecy from the Old Testament. I'm going to invite you to turn over with me to Ezekiel chapter 34. Ezekiel chapter 34, where God promises to go and seek out his own sheep, basically the people of Israel. So Ezekiel 34, and we'll start in verse 11. This is an oracle that the prophet Ezekiel gives. And keep in mind, when they use the language of shepherds in this oracle, they're talking about the prophets, the people who are leading the people, the kings, the priests, who should be caring for the people. But instead, God has been pretty fed up with them. And as a result, he promises to come and be the shepherd for Israel. Come and find the lost sheep. So check this out in verse 11. For thus says the Lord God, behold, I myself will search for my sheep and will seek them out. As a shepherd seeks out his flock when he is among his sheep that have been scattered, so will I seek out my sheep, and I will rescue them from all the places where they have been scattered on a day of clouds and thick darkness. And I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries, and will bring them into their own land, and I will feed them on the mountains of Israel, by the ravines and in all the inhabited places of the country. I will feed them with good pasture, and on the mountain heights of Israel shall be their grazing land. There they shall lie down in good grazing land, and on rich pasture they shall feed on the mountains of Israel. I myself will be the shepherd of my sheep, and I myself will make them lie down, declares the Lord. I will seek the lost. Sounds a lot like the verse, Luke 19, verse 10, does it not? I came to seek and to save the lost. And I will bring back the strayed, and I will bind up the injured, and I will strengthen the weak, and the fat and the strong I will destroy, and I will feed them in justice. God planned all along to come and find his sheep. And what we see here in Luke 19, 10 is that Jesus is living out that very prophecy. I'm going to come find my people, and guess what? Jesus is the Son of Man saying, I have come and I'm seeking out my lost sheep. I just found Zacchaeus. Jesus has been very intentional. And Zacchaeus is the end of the story of Jesus' mission. Now it's going to transition into his death. But right here, he's lived out his mission to find the lost sheep, to bring him in. And so that's why he walks up to the sycamore tree and says, Zacchaeus, come down, because it has to happen today. I have to come to your house. Jesus was on a mission. And it's because Jesus is on a mission and God's on a mission to reclaim the lost that you and I are also invited into that same mission. When Christ leaves earth, he commissions his disciples to go and make disciples of all nations. That the church also has a mission it's supposed to be about. Are we on that mission? Do we participate in that mission? So today we conclude the four times I've been speaking here, and each time we've looked at a meal scene. And each time Jesus does something different. In the feeding of the 5,000, he was providing manna in the wilderness, providing for those that he welcomed, the crowds. Then we looked at Mary and Martha, where he had women disciples come and sit at his feet. Last week, we saw where he went into a Pharisee's home, watched them elbowing each other, trying to figure out who's more important. And he said, no. Just come as you are. Come, take the lowest place. And in fact, when you host a party, invite the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame. Invite people you don't normally invite to your parties. And so as we look at this last one, where Jesus now invites himself into Zacchaeus' home, and we see this conversion moment, I'm going to invite you to think about your own practice of eating meals. And invite you to think about, is there a way you can use meals to do what Jesus did? Luke has more meal encounters than any other gospel. And it's over those meals that he does this ministry, where he disciples people, where he brings them the good news about Jesus Christ, about the kingdom that's coming. So think about this. If you eat three meals a day and you have 7 days a week, you have 21 meals in a week. That's a lot of times. Now, meals can be very perfunctory. I know at one point in my life, I imagined if I could invent a pill for lunch that you could just take and there would be like a full course meal right there, I would do it. I was so tired of sitting down eating lunch. It was like just really annoying. I just thought I could get more done if I could just pop a pill for lunch and we go on with life. But think about it this way. You have 21 opportunities, and it can be either just perfunctory, get food in my mouth, I can go on living life, or it could be a place where you can invite somebody into that space and use it to show them hospitality. You could use it for discipleship. You could use it for evangelism. And so you have 21 times each week. Can you take just one and be intentional with that? Maybe it's at work where everyone's going out to lunch. Maybe think about, how do I bring this love and hospitality of Christ into that space? Or maybe you can disciple someone over breakfast. Maybe there's a younger father or a younger dad, or maybe there's someone else in the church that you don't know. You could go out for lunch or breakfast. How can you take just one meal, one of the 21 times you're going to eat this week, and use it for the kingdom? Because it's over meals where people share something. You can have opposite worldviews. You can have clashing worldviews. But yet we all have to eat stuff. Whether you're an atheist, an unbeliever, whatever you are, you have to eat. And Jesus uses those opportunities to break down barriers, to meet with people, and to show them the love of Christ. And because eating is such a common thing, it easily breaks down barriers. You can talk about how good the food is. You can talk about what you like, what you don't like. It helps to break down those barriers. It's not just an interrogation moment. It's a shared moment. And in that space, if we can use that and harness that for the kingdom, what can God do with that? So I want to invite you to think about, if Jesus is going to use his meals to be intentional, to live out this mission of seeking and saving the lost, how might you be able to do that this week? Maybe it's just the neighbor kid across the street. Maybe it's just the neighbor once taking them a meal. Whatever that can look like, would you consider taking just one meal this week and using it to bless somebody else in this world? Will you pray with me? Dear God, we are grateful for the story of Zacchaeus. That reminds us that you do call us to radical discipleship. That costs us often, costs us financially. And yet, when we give our hearts over to you, and to you alone, we are free. So help us have the generosity and the hospitality and the ability to look past the needs of this world to see the goodness that you have given us, and that the glories of the kingdom are those who are willing to follow Jesus regardless of the cost. May we be those kinds of people. In Jesus' name, amen.